now there's just generally more opportunities to have or create things that engage with or deploy certain tropes of news or certain tropes of journalism or certain tropes of conventional media without actually having necessarily the resources or rigor underneath it to actually create the structures upon which to build the commentary. Or it's not even, it's not a generational thing so much as just a platform thing. And the idea of like, well, on the one hand, democratization of media, yay. But on the other hand, well, I mean, we've seen where that is getting us. I mean, like, Twitter was and can still be an immensely useful and valuable thing because it basically Twitter is largely, I mean, there is a lot of enormous amount of original reporting, but it's also brought by and large sort of this ongoing, ever rolling meta conversation about the news, about how about how information is reported, how it comes out. And I mean, the commentary on it, of course, but also just pointing out the things that sort of fall between the stories, between the lines. I mean, it is media criticism and it can and often has been very valuable media criticism. And I feel like Shortcuts originally and was intended almost as an extension of that, of sort of how do you bring the Twitter conversations, or at least the better ones, to an audience that may not necessarily actually be on Twitter. So how do you sort of explain the kinds of discussions, the worthwhile discussions that are or often have been taking place there, and use those as sort of jumping off points for conversations? And I think that's really good and really valuable. And I think the question now is, first of all, is there's less news than ever, but as Twitter is also
more garbage than ever.
More garbage than ever, as and has been redesigned in a way that to deliberately lean into the meta conversation.
It leans into polarization.
Basically, we have all the voices that we had more that we previously had on Twitter, but less of the actual information underpinning it. The non-information, the worst shit is elevated.
What's happening in the industry, if we look at this as the, you know, what's the problem to solve, is there was a world in which we created media that was not a product, but a service. And it operated and people bought it and engaged with it because they trusted it as a source of information that was more trustworthy than government, because government was just going to sell them some policies or, you know, try to spin them. So in the ideal world of legacy media, when it all works correctly, you've got people who are working for the reader. And when that strays from its mandate, it became something to critique. It would be shocking. It would be scandalous. What's happened with the evolution of journalism is that the worst stuff rises to the top.
And where actual news is banned outright.
Yeah, or where actual news is now banned outright. That's right. It's like I'm still living in a world where I imagine that there's news on Meta. But, you know, also when I'm watching and I'm thinking about these new platforms, you have to say, well, why are people getting into them? Like, some people are like getting in as good faith actors who want to have a valuable discussion that belongs in democracy. And other people are getting in, and they have a right to do this, simply to monetize. I watch some of the TikTokers and they're sitting there, they're talking to somebody, and then they'll interrupt and go, "Ooh, I just got a rose. I just got $5. I just got $5. It feels like a little bit of a pay for play. Are the motives just to shock, to get more people engaged and paying? Like, the public service element is not what's motivating it, I guess. And so there's not the motivation to be accurate or to be honest if your motivation is just to get the next $5. Clearly, we all want to pay for our job, but like I said, there was a world in which we had even decided in journalism that sometimes we would cover stories that were going to be unpopular. I've done that here at Candleland, where I've chosen stories that I know maybe aren't going to get the most clicks, but are going to have great service. Indigenous stories don't get as many clicks as non-Indigenous stories. They just don't. But that doesn't mean that you don't do them. But if I was completely motivated by my bottom line, you know, I wouldn't be able to do those stories. I'd be doing Sex and Kittens because that's what sells. Like, it's a great opportunity to have all this media where all these voices are moving in. But where's the anchor now for the reason why we create journalism? And I actually think that we need this show more than ever.
Maybe the reason I'm bringing this up at all, for a show that most of its life has, for the first 10 years was or is like a reflection or an extension of Twitter discourse. And now that I'm about to, you know, take at least 8 months off of it, where's editor-in-chief? Do you see this show going from here?
You know what, Jonathan? If I've heard anything over the past couple of months that I've been here from our listeners, I just have gotten hundreds of emails of people telling us, they want media criticism. And Candleland can be proud. Like, it was one of the first places that had professional journalists come in and go on the record and talk about what was happening behind the scenes, behind the walls, inside newsrooms. And that was not easy to do. It broke the silence, I guess, here, and made open discussions of what's happening inside newsrooms something that journalists could do. And I think that transparency is so important for the public, particularly in times like now when things are being cut. How do you do an investigation at CTV or at Global when most of your investigative journalists have been laid off? That great talk that we had with Justin Lang when he was telling us that scrums don't really happen up on the Hill anymore. People are writing off of press releases. People are writing from their homes and not getting out into spaces where they actually see what's going on. Those are all incredibly important things to know about what's happening inside newsrooms right now.
Yeah. The criticizing is usually the fun and the easy part, the calling out bad. But the act of explaining, of criticism, less in the sense of like, oh, is this a thumbs up or thumbs down or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 star review, and criticism in the sense of like, oh, this will be a thoughtful, earnest effort to explain and explore why something works or doesn't, and just trying to basically enlighten people to the techniques and mechanisms that are working under the surface that brought you this product overall.
Yeah, pulling back the curtain and showing people how stories get made. I mean, there's room for public education. There's room for us to also look at disinformation, to look at how journalism is operating in the new world, even if it is via, TikTok, or how the platforms are working to suppress some points of view and elevate other points of view. Those are all things that we have to talk about, because our media world right now has really shifted. And so the critique of it is going to shift. It's got to be a serious critique. Like, we've got to take what we do seriously. And I've heard a lot from the audience that they really want that journalistic critique.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to listening. Karen, as you know as well as, if not better than anyone on this show, we like to duly note things.
I love duly noting things.
Yes, what would you like to note duly today?
I have the painful pleasure of duly noting that a certain colleague of mine who happens to be on the show right now is the proud recipient of a Massey Fellowship. Congratulations, Jonathan Goldsby.
Yes, I was deducing that. I think I'm the only colleague of yours who's on the show right now. I mean, yes, James is lurking in the background, but yes, this is the first to me. And thank you. Yes, I'm one of the William Southam Journalism Fellows for the coming 2024-25 academic year. And so I'll be taking an 8-month sabbatical or break from Candleland to take a bunch of courses in whatever subjects I want.
These fellowships are like awesome, and it's such a great opportunity. But for now, I just want to say congratulations. It'll be a hard 8 months without you, but I'm so happy for you that you're getting this opportunity. It's great.
Duly noted. And I would like to note duly Kevin O'Keefe, who is actually sitting to my left in the studio right now and who will be effectively filling in for me for the next 8 months. He's a refugee from W5 and was previously at Extra, where he worked with Archie. Extra having formerly been branded as Canada's Gay and Lesbian News. I can't remember what tagline they use now, but it's more broadly, it's now an online queer publication. But I look at it particularly duly note that he is not the Kevin O'Keefe who writes the Drag Race recaps for Extra. That is a different person named Kevin O'Keefe, who has a second F in O'Keefe. And so if you have strong opinions about Kevin O'Keefe's Drag Race hot takes, this is not the Kevin O'Keefe to whom to direct those.
Okay, well, there's a Kevin O'Keefe apparently with two Fs, and a Kevin O'Keefe that has one F. And we have the Kevin O'Keefe with one F.
We have the one F.
Make of that what you will.
I find the two Fs very pretentious, so I'm glad I only have one F. And I'm recording this conversation. I was going to submit it to CSIS, but I guess that's not a good idea, so I won't do that.
Great to have you here, Kevin.
Duly noted.
Karen, are you familiar with the website TV Tropes? I think we need a new trope, and that I was surprised didn't exist, called overeager narc. A sort of person who perhaps enthusiastically volunteers or offers to wear wire on behalf of the state.
I know where this one's going.
Well, I hope so, since you know what we're talking about today. So So now, to switch gears, are you familiar with Adam Szivo?
Yes, I am familiar with Adam Szivo, a columnist for the National Post. Mm-hmm. His background, I believe, was in film. He did some commercial work. He did some artistic kind of videos. I actually thought he was quite good at them. Szivo covered a lot of stories that were involving LGBTQ2S. Very different from what he's doing in the National Post, though.
He started writing for the Post in early 2021 as a contributing columnist. Early columns are what I would describe as maybe relatively generic moderate conservative. And as he, you know, contributed more and more frequently over the next few years, I would say that, like conservatism more generally, he pretty much shifted into culture war conservatism. He is best known, both probably most highly regarded and reviled, for his coverage of Safe Supply, which he is extremely critical. And his, you know, writing on that is a coverage of that has ended up influencing policy in Safe Supply across Canada.
It absolutely has. He has met with Pierre Poilievre, and Pierre Poilievre frequently quotes him. Yeah.
We're not actually going to talk about the Safe Supply coverage today. Jesse has touched on that in the show many times before. I believe the backbench has touched on that. Today, we're going to talk about Ukraine. So in early 2022, after Russia invaded Ukraine, Szivo went over there to cover it. He didn't really have any prior conflict reporting experience that I'm aware of. He had limited journalism experience, but, you know, certainly a bold thing to do. But it's not unheard of for journalists, including many respected journalists, to have gotten their start by taking similar risks, putting themselves into a conflict zone.
It is actually a crazy thing that young journalists do. And he's not the only person with no war zone experience that I saw pop over to the Ukraine during that period.
He filed for the Post from there for, you know, on and off throughout 2022, a little bit in 2023. But just the past couple weeks, we've learned about something else he got up to in Ukraine while he was there. At the same time, he was freelancing, covering it for the Post. This started actually with a tweet from, or an ex-post from CSIS from August 8th. I mean, it's weird that the spy agency is tweeting anyway, but like, here's what they said. Has a stranger ever tried to inflate your ego? It could be elicitation. Elicitation is a set of techniques used by foreign agents to extract information from you. To learn the warning signs of elicitation, read the CSIS Travel Security Guide. Yes, I'm sure everyone will do that. And so he responded to that saying, well, people are dunking on this tweet, but this actually happened to me in Odessa in early 2023 with a guy who seemed to be a Chinese spy. I ended up organizing a small sting operation with two Ukrainian intelligence officers to figure out what his deal was. So that raises a lot of questions.
Oh, yeah, it does.
And he later expanded on that in one very, very, very long post. And then he further elaborated on it in an article or an interview with Luc Lebrun for Press Progress. And then Szivo has also filled in for Alex Pearson on Global News Radio sometimes. And around the time that Luc Lebrun started to ask questions about this, he also went on the radio show and gave this maybe basically a 20-minute explanation, good thing to fill airtime, of what happened. That hasn't been posted online, but Luke happened to record it live and has been kindly shared that with us.
I look over and I see this, you know, Chinese guy. I'm going to give him the pseudonym of Bao. And he was speaking English loudly. And I was like, okay, I'm very interested in understanding minority experiences in Ukraine. I've written quite a bit about that, whether it be LGBTQ Ukrainians or African refugees in Ukraine. And I go and I say hi to him. And I think this guy could be a friend. And he introduces himself as Bao. I say, hey, I'm a Canadian journalist. And he says, oh, he's had a lot of experience in Canada, too. He immediately procures in Ontario's driver's license. And I was like, OK, well, that's interesting. And I think to myself, I really want to understand this guy's story, because, I mean, with any journalist, you are always looking for something interesting.
Yeah. So he met this guy and they tried to get together for drinks. And then he started to have sort of weird feelings about him. Leo is Szivo's boyfriend.
And as we're taking the taxi away, Leo says, I don't like that guy. He seems kind of greasy. And he was kind of greasy. You know, he had like tattoos. He was saying bro a lot. His whole vibe was a little bit off.
So he starts digging online, Googling this guy. And they're definitely, I mean, if Szivo is accurately describing this, like there definitely are questions. It's definitely the sort of thing with where as a journalist, you're like, oh, this is raising lots of questions about who is this guy? What is his deal? Why does he seem to have photos on his Instagram that are actually, you know, sourced from TripAdvisor. Like, he wasn't actually at a hotel in Ottawa, but was just using a, you know, posing a photo from TripAdvisor on his Instagram page.
Oh, okay. That's a little weird.
Why has he spent time in Canada, in Belarus, in China?
We find out that, you know, the guy attended an elite middle school in the UK for when he was like 12, 13 years old. And then he went to high school in Ottawa that actually seemed legit. And then afterwards, he went to go study Russian and diplomacy at the State University of Belarus.
And he becomes convinced, essentially, that Bao is, in fact, a Chinese and or Russian spy, or perhaps involved with both. He indicates, like, well, maybe he would write about this at some point, but he considers this, like, an imminent threat. He comes under the impression that they were trying to maybe kidnap him. And so he tries to loop in the authorities. His evidence for all of that I would describe as fairly circumstantial at best.
I actually really like the way that Press Progress described it. They called it dramatic and fantastical.
Dramatic and fantastical, that's exactly it. And so when he relayed this on the radio, he opened the first segment with the James Bond theme and the second segment with the Get Smart theme. And he does have a sense of humor about it. He said it's, I think, it was less James Bond and more Mr. Bean. And as I was going through this and you know, pouring over TV tropes and talking to people, what does this remind me of? The consensus seems to be Dwight Schrute, the character from The Office, played by Rainn Wilson.
How do we get to Dwight Schrute?
I actually haven't seen The Office beyond the... I've seen The British, but I haven't seen The Office beyond the first season, but I'm certainly familiar enough with it. And it's not hard to find appropriate clip.
Oscar visited Mexico when he was 5 to attend his great-grandmother's funeral. What does that mean to a United States law enforcement officer? He's a potential drug mule.
That's right. I forgot. It's been forever since I've seen The Office. I forgot how obsessed that character was with being a spy or working for the government. Okay, yes.
So he really wants to bring this to the attention of the authorities.
So I took everything that I saw, all the information that I had, these weird interactions, and I wrote this really long report about it. And then I tried to submit it to CSIS, and then they like... I spoke for an hour on the phone with CSIS being like, by the way, this is what happened. Are you going to do anything? Can you keep me safe? Are you going to warn other journalists? And, you know, the guy seemed like just really unengaged with his job. And then he's like, yeah, you know, we don't accept PDFs. I made this report so beautiful. It was full of screenshots, references, explaining what happened.
We don't accept PDFs?
Yeah. So then I had to like submit it in the text box and I had to do like 10 different submissions because the report was so thorough.
Can we just like say that if he really wanted to bring it to the attention of the authorities, the normal way that a journalist would do that is they write about it.
Yes,
they would
exactly.
publish it.
And that's the thing is I feel like you and I've had lots of debates and discussions about advocacy journalism and what is advocacy journalism. But I feel like I don't think that, and this isn't, but I do feel like it's okay to practice advocacy as a journalist so long as the advocacy is conducted fully through the work
yes.
transparently itself. So long as everything is being conducted fully in public via the work.
But this is next level.
But this is not via the work, right? This is the exact opposite.
You and I have been working like with the team at Candleland on creating a JSP, and I didn't think I had to write in it. If you come across something that's very newsy, don't go running to CSIS behind the scenes. Just publish the damn thing.
He doesn't really get anywhere with that. Then he essentially tries to get the attention of the Ukrainian authorities. He doesn't really seem to know how to get in touch with them, as perhaps they don't have an English language web form. But he basically goes and finds people at like a checkpoint and tries to uses Google Translate, tries to convey it to them. Doesn't really, having a hard time conveying what he's trying to convey. Eventually, using Google Translate and then I think some Duolingo, manages to be connected with people who will at least listen to him and hear him out.
And then at the end of it, they're like, yeah, you know what, this sounds pretty concerning. And I said, well, what are you going to do? And they said, well, we don't have enough information. Well, that wasn't going to cut it for me because I wanted to make sure that I was safe. So I said, hey, like, I'm a filmmaker. I have a microphone with me that I can just tape on. Why don't we just like go for dinner and then I'll just record him and then we'll see what happens. They said, okay. They're like, are you sure? Do you feel safe with that? And I said, yeah, you know what? I would feel safer knowing what's happening around me than just leaving this guy around in the city, you know, to do whatever with. I have dinner with this guy. Bao brings his wife, who's half Chinese, half Ukrainian. You know, her name is Yulia, another pseudonym we're going to give them. And like, their story is full of holes, you know. They really can't explain.
Ooh, do they seem married? Or does it look like they're Mr. and Mrs. Smith? Like
no, there's no love. There's no love.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Right. All right, there you go. All the signs to once again.
Yeah, and like, he mentions that he loves Eastern Europe. I ask him, well, where have you been? He mentions every country except for Belarus. I ask him, did you formally study Russian? He says no, even though on his LinkedIn, he says he formally studies Russian. He says that he moved to Ukraine in like August of 2022 to expand his tire business. And I was like, okay, sure.
And that's basically it, except he later learned or had reason to believe the guy and his wife basically decamped to Belgium afterward and takes that as a further sign that something was indeed amiss. And this is the point where, like in a fictional narrative, there would be something that would be shown, probably not necessarily to the characters, but certainly to the audience, that would show, that would indicate that, oh, the protagonist was actually onto something all along, whether or not they actually were able to obtain justice for it or get people's attention. Their hunch was actually borne out or had reason to believe it. But this is real life.
In a drama, it would be borne out. And in a comedy, you would find out that the guy is like actually, just a regular guy.
Yeah.
It could go either way. We don't know if this is a drama or a comedy yet.
No, and I don't think, I think we pretty much know it's a comedy. I think Zevo knows it's a comedy, but we also don't know what the resolution is, because I don't think when you actually look at it, and like presuming he's accurately conveying this, there's reason to believe this person was sketchy and there are at least questions worth Googling. But to actually feel like, oh, I caught this spy, or at least I did my duty. So, yeah, kind of sort of an ethical no-no. Generally speaking, Press Progress, canvassed various experts in journalism ethics, including a few who I believe are your friends, Karen, one of whom is Sonia Fatta of Toronto Metropolitan University, and definitely expressed with this the concerns you would imagine about, like, this is not something that journalists would generally do, and potentially this could endanger journalists.
That's a big one. This actually has like a bit of a serious turn to it, because one of the reasons that journalists don't easily cooperate with authorities is exactly that. Like, we've talked about it in terms of actually being out at protests and land back movements inside Canada, that if people think that you're gathering evidence for the police, a good example of this happened at APTN, where we're out at Rexton and the RCMP wanted our tapes and we said no when we were back and forth with them because somebody had burnt some police cars out there. That one, we didn't have evidence of it on tape anyway. But two, just the process of handing our tapes over to the police are going to make people think, well, those reporters just go out and gather tape for the police, and you don't want to be putting your people in places that are at risk. Sometimes some of the protests at the convoy, where they weren't very appreciative of journalists from particularly mainstream news when I was working there, some of the journalists had things thrown at them, bricks thrown at them, like it can get dangerous. And so when you're going out into a war zone and you're starting to spy on people for spy agencies, anybody out there working in the field, like soldiers, whatever, are going to lose their trust in journalists, can turn on journalists, can believe that you're spying for the other side. Like, this is not good stuff.
Farsen, he wasn't even the first person to have seemingly acted as a spy or done spycraft while working as a contributing columnist for the National Post. Vivian Berkovici, who was one of the ambassadors to Israel under Stephen Harper and who's been a Post columnist since 2017 or so, in 2021, Radio Canada reported or obtained evidence, strong indications that she actually was working for Black Cube, which is the sort of Israeli mercenary private spy company famous for the Harvey Weinstein stuff. And her work there was at least circa 2019 from the evidence they had, where she was sort of, they seemed to have emails where she was soliciting business. Anyway, yeah, that she's still a Post columnist.
Majoshin, Jonathan Goldsby. There's no word for goodbye in the Algonquin language. Oh. We say Majoshin, which means good journeys. Because we always presume we're going to see you again. I look forward to seeing you again in 8 months.
Yes, well, hopefully we'll see each other sooner. But yes, that is that's a very good, perfect word. Thank you for introducing that concept to me. That's Shortcuts this week. Thanks for joining me, Karen.
Thank you, Jonathan.
So listeners can email me at jonathan@canadaland.com. I believe the email address will remain active and I will continue to read it. Karen, where can people find you?
Oh, they can find me at Karen with a Y at canadaland.com.
Cool. And this episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production manager is Max Collins. Our editor-in-chief is Hugh Caron. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Hello, this is Boris Hassan. To get a feel on what's happening across the country, listen to Viewpoints. For reports, interviews, and documentaries on politics, arts and culture, the environment, housing, and more. Thanks to 30 journalists stationed in the Canadian provinces and territories. Local news nationwide. Mondays at 4:30 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM and streaming online at cjsf.ca.